From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. The vote count in Sunday's elections in Bolivia was being closely watched on Monday, with President Evo Morales' indigenous social movement called the Movement Towards Socialism appearing to have won both houses of the legislature and poised to hold the presidential palace for yet another term. For more on that and other stories around Latin America and the Caribbean, we spoke with our reporter from south of the border, Tony Solo, via Skype on Monday from Managua, Nicaragua. And as you'll hear in this broadcast, sometimes reporting from a tropical paradise includes the sounds of a tropical rainstorm.
The Bolivian right wing, they were always hoping to get to a second round because they believe that they'll be able to just squeeze in. And if you look at the numbers, and in theory they have that chance.
Yeah.
But in the same way that's true also in Uruguay. There are elections next week in Uruguay and Argentina. There are also municipal elections in Colombia next weekend.
Right.
But and in Uruguay too, in theory, the right wing have enough votes that they win in a runoff against the president of the Frente Amplio party, the candidate there. I think his name is Daniel Martinez.
Right.
It's certainly possible, but it's just very unlikely. And the same is true in Bolivia.
Right.
And if you look at that result, in as you said right at the start, the Evo Morales' party called the MAS and Movement Towards Socialism, and they have a very comfortable majority in the lower house in Bolivia's legislature. And they've also got a majority in the Senate, in the upper house. So,
right.
And whatever happens, they're very well placed to defend, suppose, for argument's sake, that the right wing somehow got in. They wouldn't be able to pass any legislation because the MAS have a very solid majority in both houses. But
right.
the thing about that is that if you look at the right wing government in the region, they're all in a mess. And it's very likely, even if it goes to a runoff in Bolivia, that Evo Morales will win. And
yeah.
It's most likely that in Uruguay next weekend, the Frente Amplio will get re-elected.
Right.
The result in Argentina, there was a presidential debate this weekend in Argentina between the various candidates. And obviously the two leading candidates are outgoing President Mauricio Macri and the candidate for the Frente para Todos, the front for everyone, in English, represented by Alberto Fernandez, with Cristina Fernandez as the vice president. They're not related, by the way. So, and in that presidential debate, and the massive public feedback is that Alberto Fernandez was came off with well over 60% approval, and Mauricio Macri, by contrast, came out with around 56% disapproval. So, and it's very, very clear that, other things being equal, Mauricio Macri's party will lose the election in Argentina next weekend, as we've been saying for some time now, is likely. And what that means is that we'll have a progressive government in Argentina, a progressive government in Uruguay, assuming that all goes well for Evo Morales, a re-elected progressive government there. And if you look at the rest of the region, everywhere else is a mess. And in Chile, Sebastián Piñera has declared a state of siege, and
right.
At the weekend he imposed a curfew. And there have been very reliable reports of outrageous abuse by the Carabinieri, the Chilean
security
police.
Security forces, right.
And also, the army is out on the streets now, which in Chile is a very, very ominous sign.
Yeah.
But, and to, And Sebastián Piñera has actually said that his government is in a war. Now, what? That's just as a result of relatively peaceful protests over the, and the trigger for the protests this time around was that Sebastián Piñera authorized a hefty increase in public transport fares, and that led to these demonstrations in the streets. Right. But in Chile, there's been for years now, there's been underlying unrest over the education system, unrest over the pension system, the privatized pension system. There's unrest over government attempts to resist reducing the working week from 48 hours to 40. The whole series, there's all the problems with the Mapuche indigenous people that have never been addressed in a serious way in Chile. And all that has broken out now in public protests, which are being viciously repressed by the Chilean authorities, using the army and using a state of siege. Now, if you look back now, the Jorge Arreaza, the Venezuelan foreign minister, after a few days of this, put the question to Michelle Bachelet and said, "Well, look, you're always so quick to condemn us if we have to use our security forces against extremely violent demonstrations, and now, Michelle Bachelet, you have this extremely violent repression against what, by all accounts, seem to be peaceful protests. Yeah. So where are you?" And Michelle Bachelet finally got round to saying something today.
Right. I mean, they've had back and forth, Bachelet and Piñera. You know, it's been sort of a seesaw presidency. She succeeded Ricardo Lagos in 2006 and did a four-year term. And then Piñera took over from 2010 to 2014. Bachelet took over 2014 until last year, and now Piñera is in charge again, and he's riding a tiger, basically. You know, the people are in the street.
A right-wing Tweedledum and a centre-right Tweedledee.
That's correct. Yeah,
and that's what that amounts to.
Yep.
And one of the strongest indictments against Bachelet, who regards herself as a social democrat, is the fact that she and her party and her ministers, when they were in government, did zero to try and improve the repressive routine practices of, never mind the army, the Carabinieri, the Chilean police, are notorious for their violence, and especially for their disgraceful treatment of women. But anyway, Bachelet can't avoid her responsibility for allowing that culture to remain unchanged, and it's remained unchanged for decades, ever since the Pinochet dictatorship.
Right.
So that's the situation in Chile. And then if you look at the situation in Ecuador, remember we were talking, and I can't remember how far we got in our discussion of events in Ecuador last time, but you may remember that the protests against the attempts by Lenin Moreno to impose an IMF austerity package were led by the indigenous people, in particular the CONAIE, the CONAI indigenous peoples group, among others. And what happened was that there were extremely violent protests. The Lenin Moreno tried to impose a state of siege after, I think it was almost 2 weeks of protests. Certainly over 10 days, he finally agreed to withdraw the IMF package that he tried to impose.
Right.
He didn't even go to the trouble of trying to get it passed by the legislature to give it some kind of democratic legitimacy. He just tried to impose it by decree. And when everything came on top and there was all the violence and he and the security forces couldn't control that, He actually resorted to moving his government from Quito to Guayaquil over on the Pacific coast.
Right, they ran out of town. They basically were run out of town.
Yeah, they were run out of town. And so eventually he withdrew the measures and agreed to dialogue. But it's far from clear what that means. I mean, they've set up this commission to, although they've withdrawn the measures, what they're talking about is introducing a packet of measures that aren't quite so bad. But and that's the impression that certainly that I've been getting from reading the news reports. So it looks like the other thing accompanying that has been fierce repression against anybody associated with the previous government of Rafael Correa.
Right.
For example, they call them prefects. The prefect of the Quito district, a woman, Paola Pavon, I think her name is. She was arrested in her house while she was asleep by Lenin Moreno's police goons, and carted off to jail on trumped-up charges that she'd been promoting the violence during the protest. And various other leading members of Correa's Revolución Ciudadana movement have been arrested. And one of them, a former president of the National Assembly, Gabriela Rivadeneira, was actually driven to seek refuge in the Mexican embassy. So what Lenin Moreno has done is he's taken this this very strong reaction and popular protest against his austerity package, which he didn't even need to introduce. I mean, the package is in order to get $4.8 million in a loan from the IMF. But that on the pretext that public debt was getting out of control. But public debt in Ecuador is well below 60%.
Right.
And people start worrying about public debt when it gets up above 60% and it starts heading a bit higher.
Right.
But Ecuador's public debt was perfectly manageable. So yeah. That whole pretext was essentially, and many observers regard it as a measure to kind of justify a series of benefits to Lenin Moreno's right-wing backers.
Right.
And at the same time, as you pointed out in the past, Don, what Lenin Moreno has done is not only sell out his government to the right-wing oligarchs in Ecuador, but in perhaps more importantly, he's opened up Ecuador to U.S. military intervention again.
Right.
I think so. I read somewhere that there are something like 6, maybe 7 U.S. military stations being set up in Ecuador. And so in part, the protests were about that, too.
Yeah.
But the thing about the protests is that because they were led by CONAI, the indigenous peoples movement, there's no knowing what they'll do, because they're very well known for being extremely opportunist in Ecuador's political context. And for example, they were fiercely opposed some measures by Rafael Correa, and actually supported an attempted coup against Rafael Correa back in 2010.
Right.
So it's easy for someone like me looking on from the outside, but I have to say I was extremely puzzled and concerned at the way Rafael Correa and his associates inside Ecuador, because Rafael Correa is currently living in Belgium. I was surprised at the way that they supported, in practically an unconditional way, the protest by CONAI, and it looks as though CONAI have actually sold out the politicians associated with Rafael Correa, because there's been zero protests from them about the repression being used against Rafael Correa and his associates in his political movement inside Ecuador. And at the same time, it's not at all clear what CONAI are actually negotiating with Lenin Moreno. It sounds like all they're going to do is extract a few concessions and then allow Moreno to impose a not quite so bad IMF package. That's what it looks like at the moment.
But not quite so good either. I mean, if as if there were such a thing as a good IMF package. You know, we have to keep in mind also, despite, you know, the whole what was visible that went on over this period, Moreno did come to us through Correa. So, you know, Correa owes the people of Ecuador, really, him getting this, you know, setting this correct. He brought Moreno to them as someone to be trusted. He endorsed them. Right. He brought him to the fore. And, you know, if anyone was deceived, it was he that was deceived. And it was his imprimatur that allowed it to deceive the people of Ecuador, or he conspired to deceive the people of Ecuador along with Moreno and whoever backs them. I mean, he has an obligation to set this correct.
Yeah, and I think Correa does have a case to answer, but it's very easy for people on the outside to make those kinds of judgments.
I don't know which it is. I'm saying if I'm Lenny Moreno, I know that this is what I told the people of Ecuador was going to happen, and I put my name on it, and instead this is what did happen. You know, I certainly have more of an obligation to try to correct this than someone who's a stranger to it.
Right. Well, it remains to be seen what's going to happen. I suspect that the protests are likely to start up again once people realize that Moreno has betrayed them, because it's very clear that Moreno is a treacherous, deceitful individual. He'll try and play people both ways for as long as he can, while he advances his own agenda. But let's see what happens. But the nitty-gritty there is that Ecuador is very, very unstable and could blow up at any time. And again, in that context, one has to look at the way Lenin and Moreno behaved and the reaction of the Inter-American Commission and the UN Commission for Human Rights, Michelle Bachelet again. There's practically zero condemnation of Lenin Moreno's imposition of a state of siege or calling out the army.
Right.
And when you compare, and it's just very, very clear, and Jorge Arreaza was absolutely right to call out Michelle Bachelet for her double standards and hypocrisy.
Agreed.
Because that's what, and if you compare the way the Inter-American Commission and the UN Human Rights Body reacted to events in Nicaragua, where the army were never called out to repress peaceful protesters. There was never a state of siege imposed. There was never a curfew imposed, right? And despite the extremely violent events that were taking place.
In Venezuela as well. You know, it's the same. If Maduro, for example, after all of the violence and helicopter slamming into the courts and everything that happened there, you know, if Maduro called them thugs, you'd have Bachelet and a bunch of other people from the OAS and everything else say, you know, he's violent, he's a dictator, he's encouraging violence against the, you know, opposition, etc., just for name-calling. And here what we see in Ecuador, and we see every time the right gets their hands on the government and people protest, is abject brutality. Killings, official killings, and beatings and intimidation to keep people cowed and out of the streets.
Yeah, and you see the similar events in Brazil. Whenever there's a protest in Brazil, as often as not, the army are called out, and the police are extremely repressive. But it's all part of the crisis of these right-wing governments.
Yep.
And you and I have been saying for a long time that they're bound to fail because their policies are completely unsustainable, either socially or economically.
Right. These people do not go into the street over, theoretical disagreements, over fine points of ideology or whatever. They go into the streets because actions are taken by these right-wing governments that make their lives untenable almost immediately. And they have to react. It becomes a matter of survival.
Yeah, and for example, take the case of public transport. And public transport, it might not be as important as in the United States as it is in our countries south of the border.
Right.
But public transport is absolutely key for low-income families to be able to get to and from work at a reasonable cost.
Right.
And so if like Sebastian Pinheiro did. You give a hefty hike to public transport fares, and that's a direct blow at the most vulnerable people, low-income families in Chilean society.
Yep.
And similarly in Haiti.
Yep.
And what's going on in Haiti, the protests continue in Haiti. It looks as though there's going to be a teacher's strike on top of everything else. And another person was killed the other day by police in the demonstrations. What are they protesting about? They're protesting about a hike in fuel prices and also about corruption under both this government and previous government that wasted resources, multi-million, hundreds of millions of dollars of resources that Haiti benefited from under the Venezuela's Petrocaribe program. So, and again, what does that mean? It means that these governments, Haiti, Chile, Ecuador, they are acting directly against the most basic interests of the great majority of people.
Yep. I mean, you've got hospitals that are out of oxygen, for example. You've got the New York Times is even reporting on this stuff. And how many people, for example, the Clinton Foundation, it's just about every one of these people that goes in with their white man's burden nonsense into Haiti to, you know, we're going to fix it for this, ends up, it's another, you know, bunch of shipping containers of wealth out of Haiti into their personal bank accounts. It's been going on since the beginning of the 1800s when they first threw the French out of there. They've had to pay for their own freedom, stole the gold and everything else that wasn't nailed down, and it's been going on there ever since, like, 1804.
Right. And then, so then I then take a look at Honduras. In Honduras, you have a president whose brother has just been convicted of on very, very serious narcotics charges the United States authorities. And various allegations have been made directly against Juan Orlando Hernandez, the Honduran president himself. And there are widespread protests in the country, and I haven't been following closely how the protests have been going, but in Honduras the police are notorious for their brutality even against completely peaceful protests. So again, in Honduras you have this right-wing government, extremely corrupt, widespread major public protests taking place. And then if you go to Colombia, in Colombia, where they have their municipal elections next weekend, on the same day as Argentina and Uruguay have their national presidential elections, in Colombia, you've had, I'm not sure what the score is at the moment, but certainly over a dozen candidates in those municipal elections have been killed. I need to check up on, because the campaign's been going for a couple of months now.
Yeah.
And it's probably a lot more than a dozen. But just over the last week, and I think a total of 7 indigenous peoples and community leaders have been murdered by paramilitary forces in Colombia. Like the silence from people like the Inter-American Commission for Human Rights and Michelle Bachelet is deafening.
Right.
And if that were happening in Argentina, if you had a dozen candidates for municipal office one indigenous or community leader a day being murdered, and it's absolutely clear that there'd be a huge outcry and condemnation against the Venezuelan authorities if that was happening in Venezuela. But because it's happening in Colombia, there's complete silence.
Yep.
And so, you know, and in all these countries, let's look at it. Got Colombia, you've got Ecuador, you've got Chile, but Bolivia's election process was remarkably peaceful. All the observers said it was a completely normal election, very well behaved electorate, very high turnout, around 80%, Dom, and 80% turnout.
That's
voting is mandatory in Bolivia, but normally they have a turnout of about 70%,
right,
and the turnout's up around 80%. So if you look at Bolivia in the context of Ecuador and Chile and Colombia, or even Peru. And Peru, the conflict there is continuing. You may remember about, and the last time we talked about this was about 3 weeks ago, I think. And in Peru, there's a constitutional crisis because the legislature wanted to throw out the president, and the president beat them to the punch.
Right.
And it dissolved Congress. And so now it's being that whole matter is being decided in the Supreme Court, which was the very subject of the dispute in the first place. They're going to decide whether the dissolution of Congress was legal, and that takes place in a context of massive public discontent and rejection of Peru's political classes. And every one of the last presidents over the last few years is either in jail or on corruption charges, awaiting trial for corruption charges.
or recently released for time served or whatever, right?
And Alan Garcia, who was heading for the courts on corruption charges, killed himself.
Yep.
So that's, you know, and that gives you some idea of the political crisis in Peru, although they haven't had the kinds of major nationwide demonstrations that we've seen in Ecuador and Chile.
Right. Yeah, you even have a father-daughter team who first their president and then end up, in the dock over corruption.
Right.
Maybe with cells on, he's in cell block D in the male side of the prison, and she's in cell block F in the female side. The whole system is, it's not even that, party A comes in and prosecutes party B, and then party B comes in and prosecutes party A. No matter who it is, every one of them, they prove like a prima facie case almost, where they catch them with their hands in the cookie jar, and it's just, this is the way we do business here. And you don't hear a peep out of the OAS or any of these other U.S. institutions that are all over the progressive countries when, they misstep or, forget to sign a parking ticket or whatever. Then they're ready for international intervention.
And I think it's a sign of the general institutional breakdown in the mechanisms that are supposed to manage successful international relations, not just in the region here in Latin America and the Caribbean, North America, but across the West.
Yep.
And look at what's happening in Catalonia at the moment. And one of the interesting things for people like Daniel Ortega and Nicolas Maduro and Evo Morales is how patient they are and how well good-mannered they are in not pointing out to the European Union that the repression against people in Catalonia or the repression against the yellow vests in France is just as much a matter of international concern over issues of human rights as anything that may happen in Latin America.
It's absolutely true. And look, some of them, Latin America, you have, an aggregate population of 650 million, something like that, between Latin America and the Caribbean. Africa is better than 1.1 billion people. There's chunks of Asia that are, outside China and India, there's, maybe another 750 million people. There's lots and lots and lots of folks around the world that are not part of the original arithmetic, and these changes are, swirling all around them, and these international institutions are failing all of them. Look how long it took to try to get Syria close to, we're out of time, so we gotta drop it here. I'm glad to hear it sounds like the torrential rain stopped there finally. Was pretty rough.
No, the rain. We need it.
Yeah. No, I know, but it was. We didn't need it up here, and we think some of us actually got wet listening to it. But we'll catch up with you again next week, Tony. And thank you for your time and energy and effort.
Okay. Thanks a million, Don. Look forward to talking to you next time.
The same.
And that's all the news we have for you right now for Community Public Radio. I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.